The next and final matter on our oral calendar today is in the matter of the Himmish Family Share Trust and Insurance Trust. Council, as you're getting situated, I'll just re-advise you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with additional 5 minutes. If you'd like to use that time for rebuttal, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of the audio recording and the public presentation of the argument. And you've apparently lost your entire audience.
It hurt a little.
Apparently, this case is not the most exciting one on the docket, at least as far as the public is concerned. But we are most interested in it, as you are. So, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, and good morning. I am attorney Corey Genlin of Gislason and Hunter. I represent the appellant Doris Himmish. May it please the court and counsel, today I intend to talk through the basic issues on appeal, then give a little factual history, and then get specifically into the errors made by the district court. The basic issues are these. Number one, that a decedent's will can't control property that the decedent doesn't own. Number two, that a trust, just like any other person, can't control property that it doesn't own. Number three, that a district court in a trust action doesn't have jurisdiction to affect property rights in property not owned by the trust. Number four, that a co-tenancy means equality of ownership rights, and that there's no basis in Minnesota law to favor one co-tenant over another. Those are four simple propositions, but the district court violated all four of them.
Can I ask you off the page hypothetical, I'm just curious how, if I'm looking at this case right, it seems like it's property, but it's really about the operation of a business, the business element of the property. If this were a corporation that we're talking about, and you have an individual owner and another individual owner whose interest in the business shares, 50% interest in the business passes to another individual through a will, and there's a dispute over the operation of the business, and you have a trust and you have an individual fighting over the operation. The same arguments apply? Is that a proper analogy?
Yeah, I think so. And in that case, when the business, when the thing being fought over is land, if we've got a corporation or an LLC, we've got other options. When it is, how are we going to use this land because it's co-tenancy, the options are work it out or bring a partition action and break the co-tenancy. Co-tenancy
was the same option. What if both Gordon and Doris were alive? That'd be the same analysis, right? Because they both had the right to burden the entire land.
They were living in a two-vote democracy, Your Honor.
Yep.
So, what would have been the proper avenue to address the conflict about the operation of the farm?
Partition. If in fact it's simply impossible to have this situation, which went on for 7 years, of a single tenant renting both co-tenancies at two different prices, if that's just impossible, let's say, I don't think it is, but let's say it is, you bring a partition action. And frankly, if my client had believed that this outcome was possible, we'd have brought a partition action. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does.
Okay.
Isn't another option what happened here? Because we're talking about management, and it's governed in part by the family trust, because you've got an undivided one-half interest in the entire property by two parties, which goes to the whole issue of subject matter jurisdiction, because it allows the administration of the trust. That's one of the areas where the court would have jurisdiction, right?
So the co-tenancy that is owned by the trust is governed by the trust. The co-tenancy that is owned by appellant is not subject to the trust.
But both of them are an undivided one whole interest in the same property. So there's overlapping interests that you have here. And I think that's what makes it different. I struggle with your characterization of saying the trust has nothing to do with hers. I think it would be different if that was a completely separate property that she owned 100% outside of the trust, outside of the will, outside of everything else. seems like you would have a much stronger argument there to say that the trust has nothing to do with that versus here, when you have two co-tenants who have one half overlapping 100% ownership of a property.
Yep, and I want to answer that in two ways. Number one, this solution wasn't available to the district court because it diminishes one of the co-tenancies. Practically speaking, they are not co-tenants today. They are not equal partners because, and that relates back to the question of, is this any different than when Gordon was alive? And my answer is no. So it's no different. It's not a burden in a legal sense that to have this co-tenancy. It's a practical problem, and it's no different than if Gordon had said, I want to rent the land to Dennis. And if appellant had said, I want to open an amusement park. In co-tenancy, they have equal rights.
But here we have two wills that both say, we're going to rent the land to Dennis.
We have one will that is legally effective. We have one will for a person who is still alive. So the fact that...
That expresses the same point I just made, that Dennis would be able to operate this farmland. And further agrees that I'm not going to change this will when I
correct.
Before I die.
It says when I will not change it until I die, and when I do die, my co-tenancy will also pass into the trust. It will also be subject to the terms of the trust. And that contract to not change the will, this is where one of the major areas where the court went off the rails, that contract says I won't change my will. It does not say even before I'm dead, I will pretend that my land has passed through my will. If that was the intent of the parties, they wouldn't have put it in co-tenancy. They could have put it into the trust during their lifetimes if that's what they intended. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
In other words, you're saying the restriction in the will is only effective when the will becomes effective on her death.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes. And in fact, to be precise, that restriction is in the trust, which is a subset of the will, and her co-tenancy doesn't pour into the trust while she's still alive.
But the wills obviously contemplated one of them surviving the other.
That's correct, and it specifically says, and so this is the trust portion of the will, it specifically says that certain property so the trust says that my property will go into the trust. And then it says, so we're in Article 5.6, and this goes to the question of does the trust even purport to control the appellant's property? So 5.6 is this rental provision, and it says it applies to the real estate described in Article 5.3.1.3 through 5.3.1.5, okay? So if we go back to those sections, those are inherently subsections of 5.3.1, which refers to, quote, any property passing to the trust. Gordon's property, Gordon's co-tenancy interest, passed to the trust. Doris's co-tenancy interest did not pass to the trust. Even on its face, the trust does not purport to control the appellant's property. May I continue?
Okay.
All right.
So, right, I want to take you back to 5.6, because it refers to giving Dennis the option to farm, you know, and sets forth what the reasonable or fair market rent would be, et cetera. And it talks about during the admission of any trust. I mean, there is a trust. I know your client's one half undivided interest is still held by her as an individual, not in any trust. But the reference to any trust herein, why doesn't that encompass Gordon's trust?
That refers to during the time. That refers to when this is effective, during the administration of any trust. It does not refer to what it's effective against. And it inherently can only mean the property that has passed into the trust. That's what it says on its face, and that's just how the law works. The trust can't govern property that is not in the trust.
And so what property is in the trust at this point is the one-half undivided interest that Gordon possessed at the time of his death.
Correct.
So I'm still struggling to understand how you get around the fact that it's one-half undivided interest. And if that's part, that is part of the trust, and a proceeding can take place with respect to the trust and related issues as well, how is the fact that she also has a one-half undivided interest not related?
Because it is outside of the trust.
I understand that. How is it not related to it, though, when both the trust and appellant have a one-half undivided interest? They have the same interest in that property, right?
Correct.
Okay. So how is that not related?
And
I'm sorry, but it seems like you're acting like it's something completely separate and distinct that has nothing to do with this proceeding whatsoever.
It is, of course, the football that is being fought over. It is related in the sense that the trust has to do business with it. If, for instance, the trust hired a custom farming operation to till the land, that custom farming operation is related to the trust in plain English. But that doesn't mean that that contract with the custom farming operation is inherently administration of the trust or that it falls into one of the limited subject matter jurisdictions, items of subject matter jurisdiction under the statute. In plain English, it's related, but that's not the standard for jurisdiction. It's got to be one of the 24 things listed under the statute. And it's not it's not interpretation of the trust under either one of those scenarios.
Isn't it administration, though, when you're talking about how the trust is going to be administered?
So I suppose it's two sides of the same coin as to whether the court got the law wrong or whether they got the law wrong and the jurisdiction wrong. Again, going back to that custom farming operation.
Well, we don't assume error on appeal, though, so just...
Okay. Working. In the respondent's worldview, the trust could have brought a trust action against that custom farming operation over a contract, okay? And it could have said, well, collecting money against this other entity, that's part of my job as administration of the trust. But that's not a proper trust action. That's for a court of general jurisdiction to enforce that contract. Just as for the trust, if it's simply enforcing its property rights against my client, that would have to be in a court of general jurisdiction.
All right, I'm not sure I understand. As I understand it, your client first invoked this district court's jurisdiction by filing petitions seeking to remove the trustee.
Correct.
And now you're saying this court didn't have jurisdiction. That you can see why I'm confused by that.
The court had jurisdiction over the trust and the trustee. The court had jurisdiction to decide who the trustee is going to be. The court did not have jurisdiction to reach a property interest outside of the trust and say, we're going to move that right inside the trust. So the trust now wins. In any dispute of property use between these co-tenants, the trust wins. Because
I'm not sure the district court said the trust wins. But.
No, I mean, it's an again, doesn't this get back to this is an undivided equal interest? So that's sort of affects all of these issues, doesn't it?
Getting it right affects all these issues, getting it legally correct, but it is an undivided equal interest. And I would just ask the question, today, how can we say that the appellant and her co-tenant have equal interests when the other co-tenant will appoint a manager of the farm? That manager will set the rental rate regardless of what my client wants, and that client will win. That is not co-tenancy anymore. There's nothing in the trust code, there's nothing in any part of Minnesota law other than partition that allows a court to simply say, you co-tenant, you are subordinate to the wishes of the other co-tenant. And that's what happened here. And I'd like to get to the one factual issue that I'm not, based on the response, I'm not sure it's an issue at all, but there's this factual finding that it was impossible to run the land the way it has been run for the last 5 years. 7 years, that co-tenancy just is impossible. That's verifiably false on its face, because we did it for 7 years. And that is that fact, that erroneous finding of fact, is the problem that the district court thought it was solving by making my client subordinate. Once that finding of fact goes away, there is no reason to even get to the erroneous legal issues reached by the district court. I'll reserve my 22 seconds for my
well,
5 minutes.
You'll have 5 minutes, whether you use your 20 seconds now or not.
Thank you.
Your 20 seconds you'll have to take with you and enjoy them. Counsel for respondent.
May I please the court, counsel? My name is Michael Cunningham. I represent the trustee, Catherine Pollock. Rather than go through my kind of scheduled outline, I'm going to comment and follow up on some of the questions that the court asked.
Can you begin where we just left off? I mean, I was concerned as well with the finding that this, you know, that the status quo couldn't continue, as well as the notion that one co-tenant now has essential power over the other's interest entirely.
I'll come to that as well.
Thank you.
Counsel stated that the situation that existed before one of these two people died was under Article 9 of their identical mutual reciprocal wills. They could agree to change anything they wanted to, but they contracted not to do so unless they both agreed, which limits either one of them from doing it unilaterally. There was no trust in existence until someone died. So the concept
But there was a co-tenancy in existence.
There was a co-tenancy, correct. But a triggering event under the mutual estate plan is when someone dies. And it didn't matter who died first. So what happened, what did this couple agree to if one of them died? What did they intend if one of them died? They did not intend that the co-tenancy change. They didn't change that, and they didn't provide that changed, and it did not change when one of them died. But what they did agree to was that when one of them died, the farmland would be subject to common management. It's the farmland that is defined in Article 5. It is the farmland that is subject to common management. It just so happens that the ownership of the farmland, as the couple understood, was in a co-tenancy. But they could not have more expressly agreed that once one of them died, that the farmland would be put in co-tenancy. And what is a central element of the management of the farmland? They wanted to ensure that one of their children, Dennis Hemish, would have the option to lease the farmland. They wanted to protect that son's option to lease the farmland. So they said.
So we're to read that as the co-management that you say the
parties
agreed to.
That's correct. But his leasing is subject to co-management, not disparate, separate, independent management, but it's the farmland that is being managed. It's not the tenancy in common that's being managed. It's the farmland, and that's what they provided for. And then,
if they contemplated co-management.
They contemplate common management by the trustee. And so what happens when the mother dies, when Doris dies? This provision continues because if you look at Article 5, there are additional trusts provided for in both of the testamentary instruments that will continue. And Article 5 of the in the identical testamentary instruments, if they had both died simultaneously, Article 5 would come into play. It didn't matter which one of them died first, and it doesn't matter if they're both deceased. Dennis has an option to lease it. The management of the farmland, as described in the testamentary instrument, and the district court correctly found that at this point in time, that is 1,212 acres of farmland. And she talks about that. And she recognized that the surviving spouse's tenant in common interest did not pass into the trust.
But isn't it effectively stripped of its ownership of that one half undivided interest by the district court's, I guess, legal conclusion that the trustee gets to drive and make all of these decisions about the common management?
Two responses. One is she agreed to it. They both agreed to common management. So it's not like the court took away the right to independent management. The couple agreed to common management. She did not take away the ownership. And as the record reflects, and as it is cited in our brief, the surviving spouse will continue to receive rent for her interest in the farmland. There's nothing in Article 5.6 that says she doesn't get her rent. So whatever the number the rent is, and it envisions a single number for the rent of all the farmland to be what? Divided between the two owners. She didn't get stripped of her right to the rent, but she, in fact, they both mutually agreed to agree to common management. Picking up, Your Honor, Judge Ross, on your question about the management of the property, when the two of them were living, my understanding, and it's not clear from the record quite, is that the son, Dennis, farmed the farmland. And I don't know what terms he farmed the farmland. But since the husband died, there have been problems with respect to the management of the farmland. There is no current lease between Dennis and the trustee. Doris has been endeavoring to lease her interest, allegedly, at a lower than market rate. This is explained in our brief. Part of this is so that those kinds of problems will not exist, and they do currently exist. And part of the reason for this estate plan, which, as the court found, is logical, reasonable, anticipates the avoidance of future disparities and problems, including after they both die. Then we're going to have different owners, some more different owners, if you look at Article 5. These parcels pass to various of the beneficiaries. And it's going to turn out that there are four owners of this property once the wife dies. But Dennis still gets to lease it, but he has to do it subject to 5.6, which is what this couple agreed to. With respect to threshold jurisdiction, it is correct that Doris Hemish commenced actions to have our client, the trustee, removed. Both of those actions, they related to this family trust and another insurance trust. The court denied the petition to remove. But the trustee also filed her own in rem petition seeking, one, an interpretation of the trust instrument, which comes within subparagraph 4 of the trust code regarding subject matter jurisdiction. The trustee also sought instructions with respect to this issue regarding management of the farmland going forward, which comes within subarticle 24 of the trust code. The district court properly found that there was subject matter jurisdiction. And in an in rem proceeding, the scope of what the court can do is broad. In rem jurisdiction not only involves property, but it involves the administration of a trust. It involves trustees. It involves beneficiaries. The court was well within her authority to make the decisions that she did. Two more observations. What is really going on here? This couple sits down and does comprehensive estate planning, reciprocal, identical, mutual wills. Included in that was how to deal with their farmland when one of them died and after both of them died. They had set out a very precise plan. That plan was in existence when the husband died. Doris doesn't like the plan. She wants to depart from the plan. She wants to ignore the plan. The problem is, for Doris, but fortunately for the joint estate planning, she can't do it. And she is, in essence, for lack of she's stuck with what she agreed to, which was never changed up until the point in time when the husband died. The agreement to enforce under the probate code, they complied with the sections of the probate code to commit to a contractual agreement not to change an estate plan. They did it correctly under the probate code, and it's enforceable. So now the argument is, well, the tenant in common interest is not in the trust. It's not. It's not in the trust. That's true. The district court realized and recognized that that interest did not pass when Gordon died. Doris Hemmich still has her tenant in common interest. She still has her right to receive proceeds from the renting of that land. How is the land to be managed? It is to be managed by, well, first of all, it's to be leased for a long period of time, even after Doris dies, to Dennis. And Dennis is to pay rent calculated pursuant to paragraph 5.6 of the trust. They agreed to that. Who's supposed to kind of monitor? The trustee. That's who this couple selected to do it. Doris selected the trustee. She selected a trustee to provide for the management of the property. There is nothing in the Minnesota Trust Code under the sections dealing with subject matter jurisdiction which limits a court, and particularly in this case, prohibits or limits the court from dealing with the management of the farmland. There is nothing in the trust code that restricts the scope of what the court could do here. And the court clearly had the authority to do what? To deal with the agreement relating to the management of the farmland. And they agreed that it would be subject to that. Doris's counsel and Doris in their brief cite no legal authority for the proposition that the court was prohibited or limited from dealing with this topic. And Doris, in her arguments, ignores the agreement that the couple made. The law is clear that a starting point is to enforce the intent, a paramount objective of this court and the district court, and you have de novo review, in my opinion, over the interpretation of this trust instrument, is to honor the intent of the decedent. Here we request that you honor the intent, if you will, of the mutual estate planners, Gordon and Doris. And that's exactly what the district court did. It's an older case, Trust B, I think it's called.
That's the non-precedential one?
Yeah, it's non. Maybe you and I have a discussion sometime. I'm kind of unclear as to what constitutes precedent and what doesn't. I understand it's unpublished and technically not. Nevertheless, it's instructive, okay? And it's a reasonably similar circumstance. And the reasoning that the court, this court, used in that case was that there were 320 acres. subject to tenant in common interest ownership. One 180 acres husband, 180 acres of the wife. Husband dies. One spouse dies. Don't hold me to which one was died first. I'm sorry about that. And then there was an alleged property exchange. This court found that the property exchange was void. They found it was void because it violated the estate plan that was in existence when the one spouse died. And in doing that, this court stated that it was in the intent of the decedent to burden all of the 320 acres. And the district court here, Lyon County District Court, my time's up, found that it was the intent of Gordon, and I respectfully submit the intent of Doris, that all of the farmland, all 1,212 acres, would be burdened by their plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Now you have your 5 minutes.
So I'd like to address this idea that the parties agreed.
And if you would make sure you state your name for this leg of the argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Corey Jedlin, Gustafson & Hunter for appellant.
Thank you.
I'd like to address this idea that the parties agreed and Doris is stuck. Well, what did the parties agree to? The only thing on record that Doris agreed to was that she agreed to not change her will. She can read her will and she understands what a will is, that means when she's dead, the will says what's going to happen to her property.
Right, but during the course of the will, when one of them dies, during the administration of any trust, you have this clear need to manage the whole property commonly. Isn't that part of her, what she agreed to in her will by not changing it and by agreeing to the, she's not just agreeing not to change her will, but she's agreeing that the whoever predeceases the other, that person's will control and then trigger this trust administration of the property.
So let's take a step back and think about what a trust can accomplish. We've got a bundle of rights. They pass via a will into a trust. That trust can burden those rights. It cannot expand those rights. So Doris knew when she signed her will saying that she would not sign it, that she would not change it, that would be effective on her death, and that if her husband passed first, his interest would pass into the trust, its behavior would be, the management of that property interest would be constrained by the trust. That is, objectively speaking, that is the only thing she agreed to when she signed her will.
Isn't it, counsel referred to the trust B case, and that's a non-precedential new language that we're using now, meaning that it is not binding on this court. However, it can be cited for its persuasive value, and both parties talk about that case. In that one, this court held that it did, in fact, burden the other party. And isn't that really what happened here? And, I mean, I understand your argument against Trust B, but I think, in essence, your argument is, we got it wrong in Trust B. Is that the fair interpretation of your argument?
Well, a court made up of similar individuals either got it wrong in Trust B, or perhaps they were sloppy.
Either way, it's not good.
On page 2, the language in Trust B is, quote, the district court therefore did not err by concluding that the decedent's will burdened the entire 320 acres. Here's the correct way to state that. The decedent's co-tenancy burdened the entire 320 acres, and the will conveyed this co-tenancy. So the will didn't directly burden the entire 320 acres. The will conveyed the thing that burdened the entire 320 acres.
Conveyed, when you say conveyed the thing, you mean conveyed
the co-tenancy interest
to the trust.
In both cases, the trust.
Okay. Yep. I just want to be clear. If we're going to be, you know, we should be clear in language. I just want to make sure that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And that we're understanding it. I'm understanding it correctly.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the will in Trust B had the ability to place additional burdens on the testator's property interest by conveying that interest to the trust. But the will in Trust B and the will in this case had no power to burden or limit the property rights of the other co-tenant. And we heard about how, you know, we've got to stick with the trust because the trust is complicated. It tells what's going to happen. The land's going to be split up. This guy's going to rent it. It's going to go to these different people. It's no different than if Doris and Gordon had sat around the kitchen table and Gordon had said the words that are in the trust. Honey, I've got plans. We're going to divide the land this way. This person's going to rent it. This is how the money's going to go. And Doris had said, I disagree.
So in your view, 5.6 has no application until Doris's death.
It has no application on her co-tenancy interest until Doris's death.
Isn't this really an issue of what it's her co-tenancy is subject to the common management, but she still can do with her one half interest what she wants, just not for in terms of management, because the common management is what had been agreed to by both parties right from the very beginning.
Only co-management in the sense that they were co-tenants, like any other co-tenants. She agreed to be subject to the trust when she died. She did not agree to be subject to the trust now.
Except for the common management issue.
I disagree, Your Honor.
So if they're sitting at the table, though, instead of this is what I want to do, what if Gordon, what if he said, I hereby grant Dennis the option to rent the farmland, and she doesn't object?
While they're co-tenants, if he present, she retains the right to the equal right to occupation of that land. And if she sits in silence for a year and then decides, you know what, I want to rent it to a different child, then we have a partition. That's what should happen in this case.
Your time's expired.
I would have been holding my breath for a long time.
The thought bubble was just evaporated. You saw that it was here. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing. It's a very interesting case. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted. This is our last argument on our calendar today, so the court is in recess. Thank you. Have a good afternoon.